morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Chris Dorsey. He's co-author of the book, The Homeowner's Handbook to Energy Efficiency. I'd like now to welcome the folks from Teatro Paraguas, Melinda Josefina Sena de Tarnoff, also known as JoJo, Argus McCallum, and Mariana Marachlian. And they are all working on a production of Gracias a la Vida, Canciones de Violeta Parra, and that opens tomorrow night, Thursday, that is, October 9th, at El Museo Cultural. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, who was Violeta Parra?
Violeta Parra, known as Violeta del Carmen Parra Sandoval, was one of the most versatile artists to emerge from Chile in the 20th century. She was born in 1917, lived until 1967. She was the first person to create the peñas, which are community centers. Political
activism and also a center for the arts.
Right. She was born, her father was a teacher who later actually became an alcoholic, and her mother sewed to keep 11 children going.
Good heavens.
11 children, yes.
But it was a very artistic family, as I understand.
Yes, very artistic.
Artists, musicians, mm-hmm. poets.
Yes, her mother was a musician.
Her father, her brother Nicanor Parra, is known as the anti-poet. He's quite famous.
What is an anti-poet?
I'm not sure. he was trying to break the formal strictures of poetry in his time.
And so she got worldwide fame for her style of singing, and also the real. I mean, there was such a feeling of social activist. She was of a kind of socialist bent, yes, behind the singing that she did.
Yes, well, most of her songs. Let's go back. When she was 9 years old, she began writing her songs. She's written over 3,000 songs and poems.
Heavens,
we're only doing 9 of her canciones.
Yeah, if you did 3,000, you probably wouldn't quite fit into the evening format.
I don't
format.
Think so. But her songs were for the people of Chile. She wrote about she wrote for the poor people, the oppressed. She wrote their voices, what they had to say. So a lot of her songs are a little depressing, but it's because it's coming from their, point of view, that she wanted to write for, in honor of these people.
And she's a really record keeper of all the popular songs and things that There's a part of South America where the things that would happen in the country were not cultural. They were not like didn't have value for the people, mm-hmm, of the city. And there's a moment that she take that as a value and start to record and go and search for all these songs that have been singing in the country. And they're talking about the struggle of the people, yes, who doesn't have money or resources, mm-hmm, and they, living with the basics.
So really taking folk music that was ignored and bringing it to the cities and really giving it some,
right,
credit.
Not just in South America, but she actually traveled to France, and she has a multimedia art. She, mm-hmm, does tapestry and
paintings.
Mm-hmm. And if you see her tapestry is like with little things that she gets the whole thing and see like pieces of things, you can tell.
Like
that,
a collage almost?
Yeah, mm-hmm, almost like, yeah, mm-hmm, like, yeah. But like you can see those little things that she finds.
And some of them actually look like pictures you'd see in cavemen walls, how do you say those?
Yeah, they have a primitive cave painting
tapestries.
She was the first Latin American to have a show in the Louvre, a mm-hmm, single show, mm-hmm,
really?
Solo show.
Mm-hmm.
She recorded her first songs in France. Mm-hmm. She also traveled to Poland, where she was invited as one of the promising young poets from Latin America. She traveled in Russia. And back in Chile, she collected over 3,000 of these folk songs that we mm-hmm. were speaking of. Mm-hmm. She toured with her daughter and son, Angel and Isabel.
Mm-hmm. And later on, Carmen Luisa, too.
Her mm-hmm. third daughter. Mm-hmm. One of her daughters actually died.
Nice.
And that was quite a blow to mm-hmm. to Violeta.
Well, you know, some of her lyrics were banned from Latin America because of the political content in them.
So after the military mm-hmm. government came into power.
Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the songs we're doing is, can you say the name?
Mazurquica.
Yes, Mazurquica. And it's actually written in pig Latin. So it's kind of like a me han francotico parias bastánicas, polipropósicas, da 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 da. You know, it's real. Blah, 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 blah.
I didn't know Spanish had pig Latin.
It does. And it's a really good song, but it has to do, there's a lot of regime to, you know, and all this, you know.
The marching soldiers, yeah, the dictatorships.
Right. But Violeta, really, what happened to her was she, you know, she was so famous for helping people and for creating these peñas, which, by the way, she created for so that they can do their performances in. You know, they can do their concerts inside these peñas and things and recite their poetry. But she, you know, was very, she neglected her personal life. Her personal life was really not good. And she had two husbands and later on a lover who she called the gringo. And actually, one of the songs you'll hear, Run Run Se Fue Pa Norte, is about the gringo who left her, which was the final blow to her depression.
There was a Swiss anthropologist, Gustav Favre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was him. And just before, her daughter, Rosa Clara, died just when she was 9 months old. Violeta had her and left 2 weeks, you know, after she had the baby. And so she started to feel really guilty because, you know, the baby had died. She blamed it on the husband, but it was really the baby died of pneumonia. And she started to get depressed. And then when the gringo left her, she got very depressed. And she was so confused with her life of helping all these people, but yet she was horrible here. And it was horrible that February 5th, 1967, she committed suicide with a shotgun to the head.
Good heavens.
Yeah. So
let's hear her most favorite song. And this is a song that has been covered probably as much as any song ever recorded in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Gracias a la Vida. Let's hear it, and then we can talk about
and
it.
And also, let me just tell you that this recording you'll hear is the group that is going to be playing.
Are we listening to you singing?
Yeah, you're listening to me, and it is our arrangements of her songs.
Okay.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio dos luceros que cuando los abro perfecto distingo lo negro del blanco, y en el alto cielo su fondo estrellado, y en la multitud es el hombre que yo amo. ¿Quién me ha dado tanto? Me ha dado el oído que todo su ancho roba noche y día, grillos y canarios, martillos, turbinas, ladridos, chupascos,
And so that is JoJo, who we have right here with us, also known as Melinda Josefina Sena de Tarnoff, singing Gracias a la Vida. Now, how did a nice Santa Fean girl like you get involved with Chilean activist singers of the 50s?
Well, Argos, do you want to... last year, we... In fact, you have it in front of you. Why?
Yeah, I have the program right here. Last year, we presented a performance, an original piece of ours called Gracias a la Vida, Las Poetisas Amigas, which dealt with the lives and poetry of five of the early feminist poets of Latin America. And JoJo in that performance played Violeta Parra, and I think Violeta got into JoJo's blood so bad that we had to come back and do this show just concentrating on Violeta herself.
That's true. I think in the Las Poetisas, I was the last poet to be featured, and it was only 15 minutes long, and I stuck in about five of her songs, but only little tiny. And the songs are so beautiful, and just her whole life is so interesting. I think I was a little bit possessed by her. And I said, I need to keep this visual going. This needs to keep going, and I need to keep singing these songs. And I just had this whole vision of, you know, her playing her songs, you know, and seeing on stage what's actually going on in her head while she's singing these songs. And we even have some film of Violeta. And some pictures of her that will also be shown during the concert.
And we have Mariana dancing and interpreting the character through dance of Violeta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our idea was to bring some images in, you know, because of these songs and like what was really happening in her life, and to actually embody them, and so you can actually experience that in when you listen to the songs, and they're bilingual, you know, they're like singing in Spanish, so mm-hmm. you know, you can actually have a visual of what's going on, even if you don't understand the song, mm-hmm. even though it's been translated before, but just to have a feeling of what's going on with her life.
Yeah, this is a bilingual piece, so we do have a narrator, Carmela Gonzalez, who is also a native of Santa Fe, and she translates the poems, the words to the songs before the songs are sung.
And Carmela's a fabulous singer as well. She she does some of your backup vocals, yes?
Yes, she does.
What was it about the character of Violeta Parra and her life that got under your skin, JoJo?
It was my life, too. My life was a lot like her life, even though I would never do what she did at the end. I'm also the way she is. I work with children constantly. My life is always out there, and my personal life is down here, although I'm very good at my personal life. But I felt like I was really living her life, and I just really wanted people to know that although she committed suicide, she was a great, great woman, and her songs are extremely beautiful. And it kind of goes with what's happening with today, too, you know.
In the sense of?
Were you going to?
In the sense of, like, I really like how she expressed of, like, the struggle of the people at the same time. She talked about how the government and how all these things get really rigid. And that happens when you have an economic crisis, like people start to interfere. And that's why, and she really plays with this. She really can like speak it up, sing it up, and almost make fun of it, like how people get really uptight mm-hmm. and what is expected from people that is not real. And in the other side, she's telling about what is the real life of the people in the country's struggle and what they're the suffering and how there is a beauty of it all and how you can make a tapestry or something really beautiful, pieces of things that, mm-hmm. you know, it feels like she just get the garbage of things and make something up. And mm-hmm. there is this thing about the richness that it doesn't necessarily has to do with money. And I personally, folk in my life, being in South America is really, really powerful. Like, you know, my grandfather was a folk artist, and that where we're talking about peña is actually that still happens in South America. People get together and play folk music. Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing thing. Mm-hmm. And it has another kind of like a, it's recognized as part of the culture. It's highly recognized as part of the culture.
And there's just not enough Violeta Parra songs in the USA, so.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think Joan Baez, I guess, sang yes. Gracias a la Vida.
In 1974, I think, is when she made that famous.
74, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of the extent of it. And on programs like Somos Son here on KSFR mm-hmm. on Saturday afternoons from 5 to 7, we play music of Violeta Parra and many other people
very
from
good.
Chile and Argentina and, mm-hmm. and all over Latin America. Mm-hmm. But it's still kind of hasn't quite crossed over into English-speaking society.
Exactly. And so may hopefully this visual performance that we've put together, this multimedia production, will enlighten some people.
There's another song that we want to play.
Yes. Run, run se fue para el norte. This is the song about the gringo. His name was
Gustav Fevre.
Thank you. And this was actually one of the last few songs that she wrote. And it's a very beautiful song, but it's a little sad because he does leave her. But it's a very beautiful song. And it is also done by De Gusto, which is the name of the group that's playing it.
And so you singing once
yes.
again.
Yes, I am.
Let's hear it.
Carro del olvido antes de aclarar de una estación del tiempo decidido a robar run run se fue pa'l norte no sé cuándo vendrá vendrá para el cumpleaños de nuestra soledad. A los tres días corte con letras de corral, me dice que su viaje se alagra más y más, se vaya en tu fangasta sin dar una señal, y cuento a Nuvantura que pasó a la teletrar. Ay, al medio de un gentío que tuvo que afrontar un transporte por culpa del último huracán en un puente quebrado cerca de Vallenar con una luz al hombro run run debió cruzar con run se fue su viaje llegó a Tamarrucal sentado en una piedra se puso a divagar que si esto que el otro que nunca quede más que la vida es mentira que la muerte es verdad ay
so that's the other song of Violeta Parra that we will hear for now. The production is called Gracias a la Vida, Canciones de Violeta Parra, featuring the musicians and dancers of De Gusto. Now, De Gusto came together for this production specifically?
Yes, it did. And after this production, De Gusto will continue playing Latin music around town, including Violeta Parra songs.
And other things. One mm-hmm. of the things that is... nice about the song Gracias a la Vida is it's been recorded in virtually every Latin rhythm there is, mm-hmm. from cumbias to salsas to very sweet folk music style.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep, it has been.
So, Argus, what is your interest in all of this Latin American work that you do?
It basically comes from having grown up here in New Mexico as a little kid, all the way up to my present age. I've been here in New Mexico, and it must be in my blood, the whole Latin, Spanish, Chicano experience.
Well, I mean, it seems that with New Mexico, there's a connection to Spain and to Mexico, but not necessarily that much of a connection between New Mexicans and Latin Americans.
That's true.
Yeah. But and there is a, for the interesting thing is like there is a lot of like flavors in Latin America. Like the Mexican culture is really different from the South American culture.
Yeah.
And like, you know, the Argos like bring that up and like share that, and I'm really impressed.
Well, also, I think that I actually, in the past year, I've been meeting a lot of people, Mariana, like you, and then we also have El Hombre, who we call El Hombre in our group, is Rafijit, who is from Chile and did grow up around Violeta and all of those things. And he is in the show. So we do have actual flavors from, you know, Latin America that are with us. And these people have been bringing us New Mexicans other flavors, like Mariana has said. And it's very beautiful. We love it.
Well, also the whole cultural aspect of Latin America is so powerful that some of the finest poets of the last several centuries have been in Latin America. Pablo Neruda, many, many others. So
yes.
my interest in poetry has led me to Latin America.
Mm-hmm. The production is called Gracias a la Vida, Canciones de Violeta Parra, and it opens tomorrow, Thursday, the 9th of October, at El Museo Cultural, and goes on through the 18th of October. For more information, you can call 473-0143. And I just want to thank you all for being here. Melinda Josefina Sena de Tarnoff, also known as JoJo, and Argus McCallum and Mariana Marachlian. Thank you so much for being on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Gracias.
A la vida. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. I'd like to welcome Chris Dorsey. He is the co-author of the book Homeowner's Handbook to Energy Efficiency, A Guide to Big and Small Improvements. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for hosting me.
It's great to have you. So a lot of people who own their houses or apartments, but mostly houses, can save a great deal of energy. When you wrote this book, were you writing it mainly for people who want to save energy because it saves them money? Or is it more about the carbon footprint that people want to reduce? What are people really interested in these days?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that question, because we have had that question in front of us for all of the last 5 years as we crafted this book. We know that people come at the energy conservation interests from various angles. People may wish to reduce their environmental impact and shrink their carbon footprint. They may just want to save money at the end of every month. Some people may be looking at their future energy security, and they may be able to afford the utility costs now, but it does not take much imagination to imagine that in the future it's going to be difficult to pay utility bills. Some people may want to just take control of their housing. We just have a huge housing crisis going on in the U.S. right now, and we all have friends or family members who have lost their homes to foreclosure. And for many people, trimming utility costs is just an attempt to make sure they can stay in their homes. And so we don't actually have to even know what our readers' intentions are, because we just give them a formula for reducing their energy consumption, and they can use it however they'd like.
Is it easy to figure out your house's carbon footprint?
Well, the measure of your carbon footprint, both in your life in general but also in the operation of your home, is relatively easy to calculate, though there's a lot of factors that are somewhat unknowable. But one advantage of calculating the carbon footprint for your home is that you have a very simple way to measure your impact, and that is your utility consumption, as measured by your electric meter and your gas meter, or perhaps by the number of cords of wood you burn. And we actually have pretty good formulas in chapter two of the book that show you how to look at your utility bill and look at your consumption and convert that to carbon footprint. It's a little bit harder for the rest of your life. It's hard to know, for example, in traveling to work or in traveling in an airplane or even just in the food you buy, how much carbon impact you have. But we're lucky in a home that it's easy to calculate because we have meters.
So you write in the book about how people can have a home energy audit done. Is that something people can do for themselves?
Well, in fact, you know, we dedicate chapter one. We've titled it developing a plan for your home. And our intention there is to give people a tool so they can essentially do a self-audit, to walk through their home and take a look at what they have, because it's really the most important way to get started on the process of reducing your carbon impact or your reducing your utility consumption, is to take a look at what you have so you have some idea where to best apply your money to have the most effect. So, you know, we give pretty good guidelines for doing it yourself, but we also make a follow-on recommendation, which says that everybody should hire a professional to come perform an energy audit on their home at some stage. It's great to do it to do this walkthrough audit yourself before you call a professional, because then you'll have a better idea of what kind of questions you might ask and what sort of things that you couldn't assess yourself. We use professionals all the time, perhaps to help us guide our investment portfolios or to help us buy a piece of real estate or for medical advice. And so it makes perfect sense to really hire a professional and get some idea where you stand in regards to your home and its utility consumption.
On the average, how much, and I know that it varies greatly from one house to another, but how much energy can a single family house save? In other words, what percentage of the energy that your average house is currently using?
Well, it depends a lot where you stand when you begin. If you have an older home that was designed during a time when fuel was cheap, if you've done very little work on that home, and then you have a lot more possibility for savings than if you live in a home that's already quite efficient. And having said that, you know, we have pretty good guidelines in the book for a set of tasks you could do this weekend and probably trim your consumption by 10%. Maybe save yourself, you know, from $100 to $300 a year. But if you followed all the guidelines in the book, and we have a pretty good set of projects well in hand that we outline, it's quite conceivable to reduce your consumption 50 to 75%. In fact, for those of us that have looked closely at the homes in America, we think that it's quite conceivable, and in fact, it may be necessary in order to adapt our homes for the energy future that's likely forthcoming. We think it's quite possible to reduce consumption of our homes down to about 25% of what it is right now. And that's a pretty big piece of the pie.
What are the sort of quick fixes that people can do over the weekend?
Well, quick fixes, Mary Charlotte, are always popular, especially in the autumn. In your part of the country, as well as any place that has serious winter, it's time to get busy and get our homes tightened up. The really simple stuff are a lot of things that maybe many of your listeners have already heard about. Compact fluorescent lamps, I can't overstate, are probably the top energy investment in terms of return. You could go out this weekend, spend $100 on compact fluorescent lamps. You could probably save $100 in the first year. That's, you know, 100% return on your investment. You know, any place where we have relatively high water rates, you know, the installation of low-flow shower heads is always super, super popular and very, very effective. You can go out for $30 to $50, buy most low-flow shower heads, and you could probably pay off that in water savings in the first year. If you have a forced air heating system, you know, a popular thing or a very effective thing to do is to go find that heating system, and someplace in there probably has an air filter. That filter is designed to clean the air as it gets sucked out of your house in order to keep the inside of your furnace from being covered with dirt and debris out of the house. Well, that filter gets clogged up, and by replacing that $1 or $2 filter, you might be able to trim $50 to $100 off your utility costs if that filter was plugged up when you changed it. That same filter also, if you have a central air conditioning system, is going to, you know, lower the efficiency of the system in the summertime if the filter gets dirty too. Another really obvious one for people that have single-pane windows with storm windows is close the storm windows. And I know this sounds obvious, but I walk the streets of towns in America all the time and see storm windows open in the wintertime. And so I kind of sound like your grandmother now, but close your windows when it's wintertime. And those are some real good places to start right there.
In a place like New Mexico, where we are broadcasting, there's a wonderful amount of solar energy, which can be gained just simply by, you know, having your windows open, your windows facing toward the sun, facing south. Windows also lose a lot of heat. So how do you sort of, let's say you're remodeling your house or building a new house, how do you calculate the amount of solar gain that comes through your windows versus the amount of heat that's lost, even if you have pretty tight, good windows?
Well, that's a real good question, and we actually dedicate the last chapter of our book to building a new home, because while many of the guidelines we describe in the book and the projects we describe are really appropriate for either new or existing homes, we dedicate one chapter because there are some peculiar things about new homes or about major remodel jobs that you need to know about so you can optimize your efforts. One, as you mentioned, just dead on, is about the placement of windows. And in an ideal world, we'd have windows placed so the low-angle winter sun could come in the windows, especially in a place like New Mexico, and give you all that free solar heat boost. But the windows should be ideally sited so that, or located on the home, so that the high summer sun does not hit the windows, because nobody wants to have noon sun in July beaming down into their house. You can protect those windows from summer sun by having awnings over them, by having architectural overhangs or roof overhangs that shade them. And generally, windows on the east and the west side of the house should be placed a little bit differently than windows on the south. That's because that east sun, when it comes up in the morning, tends to be a little bit lower, and so it's harder to shade them from morning sun because of the angle of the sun. Same thing on the west side. And so, you know, with windows properly shaded on east, south, and west sides of the home, and with shading that acknowledges the fact or recognizes the fact that summer or that morning and afternoon sun is low and midday sun is high, you can do a pretty good job of having plenty of glass in your house, getting plenty of free sun in the wintertime, and not getting overheated in the plenty of sun in the wintertime, but not getting overheated in the summer. And so, you know, it's a simple rule of thumb that you'd like to have your windows in full sun all winter and in full shade all summer. And you do your best in the design to make that happen. Now, on the north side of your home, you know, in terms of solar heating, windows are really no use to us, unless you're in the southern hemisphere. But we still put a few windows, ideally, in the north side of our homes, just for a little bit of daylighting, and that's so you don't have to use lights in the middle of the day in order to go into those rooms on the north side of the house. But we do try to keep them minimized.
There are some things you talk about in terms of cooling, and of course, cooling is very important in warm and arid climates like the high desert. For example, you can have a cool roof. But then I was thinking, you know, in a place like Santa Fe, yeah, it's really hot in the summer, but it's really cold in the winter. What about, I mean, can you have a hot roof that will keep you warm in the winter? And would that be preferable to having a cool roof in the summer? I mean, I guess you can't have both.
Well, you've actually gone right to the heart of a sometimes difficult question to answer, and that is that if you're in Florida or Southern California or probably in most parts of New Mexico, your cooling bills are going to be greater than your heating bills. And so the cool roof that reflects a lot of heat in the summertime is going to provide a real good payback. There probably is no single measure that will pay off better than making sure you have a nice reflective or white roof coating on your home in a place like Santa Fe. Will you have some loss there in the wintertime, or will you miss the opportunity to collect some solar energy in the wintertime? Yes, you will. But it really is only as you get farther north up towards the Canadian border that the difference becomes so great that you actually want a black or a dark-colored roof. So in your climate, a cool roof is definitely going to pay off greatly in the summertime and only provide or only cause a slight loss of heat gain in the wintertime. So stick with the cool roof coating.
Well, I mean, the same kind of trade-off came up for me when I was reading the chapter on landscaping, because you can grow big, tall trees that will shade your house, but then again, you don't get your solar energy, your passive solar.
Well, sure. And again, you're playing a trade-off game here. And in an ideal world, you could have trees located on the south side of your home that have a relatively high canopy. In other words, a lot of hardwoods and trees such as ashes and maples are naturally grow with their canopy up high, and you can prune them up lower so you don't have any branches, say, for the first 20 feet. And what that allows you to do is cast a big old shadow across your house all summer and still allow that winter sun to penetrate. Now, that's easier to do in drawing a child's storybook picture of where trees should be than it is in reality, because we all have existing landscaping we have to deal with, and trees take time to grow. But the ideal shading would be high canopy trees with clear trunks on the south side, and then lower trees and bushes on the east and the west to block that low morning and afternoon sun. But you have to take both a long and a short-term view of designing landscaping, because you want it to be relatively effective when you first plant it, but then this stuff also grows, too.
We're talking to Chris Dorsey, the co-author of the book The Homeowner's Handbook to Energy Efficiency, A Guide to Big and Small Improvements. In addition to passive solar, you talk about active solar, namely solar panels. To what extent are the price of installing solar systems competitive with using the public utility? Obviously, in the short run, it's going to be some capital investment, but do you have a formula for how long for example, solar hot water heating system, a solar heating system, a photovoltaic system would take to pay for themselves?
Well, there's really never been a better time to install either solar water heating systems, which are used for domestic hot water in order to provide water that comes out of your faucets, or for installing photovoltaic or solar electric systems. The economics are quite good right now. But, you know, having said that, we always need to favor our investment in conservation measures that have even a better payback. For example, the installation of energy-efficient appliances such as washers and dryers and refrigerators will usually have a payback of someplace between 3 and 10 years at today's utility rates. And the installation of an additional blanket of insulation in your attic will probably have a similar payback of 5 to 15 years. The installation of a solar hot water heating system or a photovoltaic system is going to stretch out longer than that, and it's a little bit hard to say exactly what the economics are and when you may see payback on those, because there's great incentives out there right now in utility and state and federal rebates and incentives that'll make it a little bit more economical for you. So we really recommend that people head towards conservation first to spend their first home improvement dollars, making sure their home doesn't use so much energy, and working basically on trimming the amount of load you have. And then once you've spent those initial dollars, and that may be $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 on most homes, to get them really as efficient as they can be, then it'll make economic sense to go back and install a solar electric or solar hot water system.
What's your sense? I mean, you are, as you say, walking around the streets of cities and towns in the United States. What's your sense of how many states are actually offering some kind of incentives for people to install solar?
I'd say 3/4 of the states in the U.S. right now have some sort of incentives or rebates for solar systems. Lots of times they come through the states, but they also may come through the utility companies. And it's worth doing some research to find out what's available in your area, because you wouldn't want to install one of these systems and not take advantage of the rebates.
So what are the basic principles of having your house be as energy efficient as possible? I mean, one of them is have your house as airtight and insulated as possible.
Well, you know, the shell of the home, that the outer walls of your home that contain an air barrier and insulation, really are the first place to start. And, you know, we really can't emphasize that enough. There is, we all like to buy new doodads to help us, live a greener life. But in the end, it is the simple measures, as you mentioned, such as insulation and air sealing, that are really going to have the most effect in trimming our carbon footprint. So, make sure you take a look in your attic if you have one, peer inside the walls of your home, and make sure they're fully insulated. And this is probably not a project that most of us have ever done before, and we probably all presume that these areas are already completely insulated. But you know, I can assure you there are plenty of homes built all around the country that don't have wall cavities that are full of insulation. We actually include pretty good guidelines in the book for how to go on the self-audit and peek inside your walls and see what you've got there, and how to look in the attic and measure it up and convert it to R-value, which is a measure of insulation effectiveness. That's a great place to start. But once you've taken care of insulation and air sealing, where should you look next? I would look at lighting. There's always between 15% and 25% of the utility consumption for most families. You can go trim that by working with lighting. I would look at your refrigerator, and again, we've all heard this before, but it's worth bearing saying again that if you have a refrigerator that was manufactured over 15 years ago, it's probably time for a replacement. And I don't really advocate that everybody goes out and buys new appliances immediately to save energy, because a lot of them may have only slight improvements over the older versions. But the refrigerator is the anomaly, because there's some great new technologies out there. Current refrigerators are using probably one quarter the energy of what they did 20 years ago. And another simple guideline I can offer is that when you are ready to buy appliances, be sure to always buy appliances that have an Energy Star rating. And it actually is a pretty powerful trademark out there. The federal government's done a good job of keeping that standard real high. If it has an Energy Star tag hanging on it, it probably is one of the most efficient appliances available.
Let's say you are building a new house. Would you recommend central heating, forced air heating? How would you heat the house? I mean, in a place like New Mexico, 6 months out of the year, you still have to heat your house, or 5 months out of the year at the very least.
Well, that's an interesting question. The homes in America have evolved more and more towards central heat over the last 40 years. It's what we all aspire to. But, you know, having said that, a lot of the most efficient new homes are being designed with zoned heat. And that means that rather than having, you know, a thermostat, or sometimes you may have two or three thermostats to adjust different parts of the home, it lets you actually adjust your heat room by room. And for families that are willing to manage that type of heating, that can actually be a pretty efficient way to heat your home. You know, many homes in your region also have boilers that use hydronic heat or hot water heat to heat your home. Hydronic heat has the advantage. It is relatively more easy to zone than forced air furnaces. And so one of the best approaches you can take, whether you have a furnace or a boiler, whether you use gas or propane or electricity or even wood to heat your home, one of the best approaches you can take is to figure out a way to zone that home so that in the wintertime you don't have to heat every room in the home. And in the summertime you don't have to cool every room. You know, for example, especially in your region, there are some great designs that allow you to minimize the overheating in the summertime. Lots of roof insulation, a reflective roof coating, awnings and overhangs over the windows. And you can actually trim your consumption down pretty far. But you can also then come in and use room-by-room cooling rather than central cooling, and that can have a huge impact also. Some families may just buy a room air conditioner, just a portable air conditioner that goes in one room that goes, say, in the kitchen and the living room, and consider that just good enough rather than cooling the whole, the entire home. Or again, in your, you know, hot, dry region, the use of an evaporative cooler or a swamp cooler that just heats the main portion of the house, that can be plenty for most families. So whatever the system type, zoning is always a good idea.
For those listeners who have never, for example, picked up a hammer or really gone to the hardware store, what do people have to get past in order to realize that they can do these things themselves?
Well, you know, everybody has a different skill set and amount of time and amount of money, and that is going to determine largely those who decide to work on their homes themselves and those who hire help to do it. We've designed our book to address both crowds, and for people that are hands-on, that have a box full of tools, that may have worked in the trades, or who just like working on their homes, you know, we've given pretty specific guidelines for how to actually complete a whole bunch of these projects. But we've also been real focused on providing guidelines, especially for the bigger, more difficult jobs, like re-insulating your walls or installing a new heating system, things like that that most people will not do themselves. We've also tried to give a pretty good set of guidelines for how to hire professionals. And we do that by giving you checklists so you know what to ask for, so you know how to supervise that work, so you know what the outcome is supposed to be, because a lot of us have maybe had, you know, bad experiences over the years working with tradesmen, and we have found that one of the best things we can do is simply empower people to work with tradesmen by giving them enough knowledge that they understand what it is they're trying to accomplish. And so, you know, we've really designed the book to go both ways, for both hands-on people, but also people that are hiring help, because we never really know who our readers are going to be.
Anything you want to add before we go?
Well, you know, I think that we have a housing crisis in this country right now. We also have a potential climate crisis brewing in the background. And I think that it's a very, very sobering time to be alive, but especially to own and operate a home. And, you know, one of the best things we hope people take away from all of our work, including this book, is that we really have great opportunities as well right now to take control of our housing. We feel one of the best ways you can do that is to learn about your housing, to learn how to manage it, to learn how to trim its consumption. I am amazed how much research people do say if they're going to buy a car or buy a home entertainment system. They'll spend months doing research and hitting the web blogs and reading books and asking their friends, and yet they go out and they buy a house because they like the location and the color. And so what we've tried to do is give people the tools to manage their housing as effectively and intelligently as they can so they can have a secure place to live now and into the future.
Chris Dorsey is the co-author of the book, The Homeowner's Handbook to Energy Efficiency, A Guide to Big and Small Improvements. Thanks so much for being with us.
You know, Mary Charlotte, if anybody wants more information, there's also lots of free information on our website, too. That's at homeownershandbook.biz. That's one word, homeownershandbook.biz. There's about 200 free articles there with tips on how to improve your home.
Excellent. Good. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Sean Conlon for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month Lester Young, and in response to a request, Cerulean Skies by Maria Schneider. And I just want to say thank you to all of you who donated during the KSFR pledge drive. We thank you so much for understanding the mission of KSFR and keeping it on the air. And for those of you who didn't and said, gosh, I've missed my chance, you can always go to ksfr.org, hit pledge now, and still make a pledge to KSFR. But in any case, thanks to all of you for supporting this wonderful radio station, and we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.